Talking Landscape Photography with Christian Fletcher and Cowan.
Welcome back to Light Minded. It is 2020. Can you believe that? Like, the decade's well and truly over. Thank you very much for your support in 2019. We're planning to have a massive year this year. So thanks for staying on board, and we're always working on improving things. A big shout out to all of our listeners at the Australian Landscape Photographers Facebook page. If you haven't joined ALP just yet, you're a landscape photographer, what are you doing? Just get over and do it. There's some amazing stuff there, and you're always going to get inspiration from the other photographers there too. So make sure you join ALP today. Now, we're chatting with one of the top 25 landscape photographers in the world. And if you don't believe me, just do a Google search for Aaron Bubnik. Now, Aaron, you're back in California, which is a good thing, because when I called you in Slovenia a couple of weeks ago, I got the bill and it was $35, mate.
Yeah, he's going to sit... going to send me the bill for half of it. So, yeah. And so what have you been up to? What's been going on since our last chat?
Oh, gosh. I've been on a tear with a lot of speaking engagements. That was pretty much the whole of last month. And this month, I've been back in the office, and happily so, because so much had just piled up while I was gone. So now I'm getting all that stuff done that had piled up. Just released an e-book. That's pretty big news for me.
Cool.
Yeah. And looking forward to a workshop that I'll be starting at the beginning of next month, and getting some last minute preparations done for that.
Yeah, cool. And so this new ebook, Photographing Through the Seasons, I believe it's called. It's, tell us all about that.
Yeah, so this is a really unique book. It is a unique approach to teaching people how to photograph the season. So although it is sort of a location guide, it's in sort of in reverse of how most location guides work. Rather than starting with a location and saying, here's everything you need to know about it, here's when you should go and what you should expect, we sort of just turned that around, and instead it's a guide that starts with the seasons and says, okay, so you have this time available during X season, and you just need to know where you should go, so you know when, you just don't know where. And so this guide answers that question of where do you go. And in addition, it includes a whole lot of information about post-processing, about composition, about just conceptual ideas about the seasons. And it also includes 49 different nature tips to help the readers be good friends of the environments that they visit.
So in the book itself, like, for instance, if you wanted to go and take some photos of the Dolomites, it gives you locations for the compositions?
Well, it's just the Western United States. So there are 7 authors contributing to this book.
Okay.
We're all specialists in the Western United States. It's the Photo Cascadia team. So what it will tell you is these are the sorts of regions that have certain types of changes. For example, let's say you're talking about spring. The book will go through all sorts of different ideas of what you can do in spring. And that might range from certain types of flowers that you might want to photograph and where in the Western U.S. you might be able to find them, to things like, did you know that in spring you get wonderful high winds in Death Valley, and that's a great time to go get dynamic scenes of blowing sand and that sort of thing. So it just gives a whole range of options for each season to give people some ideas for what they might want to do when they get that time.
Yeah, oh, that sounds fantastic. It's a great idea. And it's I think the good thing about that idea is that it's something that will, because there's 4 seasons, it's something, an ebook that'll get pulled out every season and used all the time. Are you thinking about expanding it to other parts of America, or maybe just keep it to the west side?
We've talked about doing a global edition, because all of us are also pretty global. So we could maybe just pull that off. We're certain that we could get close at least, but that would be a massive project. It took us more than 2 years just to put this out.
If you're going to do a global thing, can you come to Australia, specifically Gunsborough?
You bet, absolutely. Yeah. I'm sure that one of the team has, but I would love to.
Well, we don't have sort of the same sort of seasons that you have over there. So it'll only have to be half the size, because we kind of have hot and not so hot. That's our 2 seasons, pretty much.
That counts.
Wouldn't you say, Carmen?
Sure.
Yeah, pretty, pretty much. Like, particularly in Western Australia, it's just like, you know, it's winter or summer, and there's actually not that much difference between the two seasons.
Yeah, the other season. I mean, we do have the shoulders and stuff, and we do get the autumn colours to a degree, but we don't really have native trees that are deciduous, so that we don't get that colour. The only ones that we have are obviously planted by someone else. They don't actively grow in the area. But yeah, if you're coming over and you're going to do this global, you come to Australia, Carwin and I will happily help you out with location.
All right, you're on.
Information. We know a lot about everything, don't we, Carwin?
Yeah, we'll direct her to Sugarloaf Rock for a start.
yeah, Sugarloaf Rock. So it's one of those. Sugarloaf Rock is sort of like it's El Capitan, I guess you could say.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, not quite as tall, not as grand. You probably could climb it pretty easily without a rope, and if you fell off it, you would die.
Okay.
You would most likely die, but you would hurt a lot of the way. You wouldn't die straight away. You would die after an hour of broken bones.
That's a great sales pitch. You know what? Yeah. I just developed a very strong attraction to this mount.
Did really well there, Fletch.
Yeah. Well, see, we can help her with the ebook with descriptions like that. You know, Sugarloaf Rock, come there, come and fall off. You don't need a rope.
We need 9 authors die horribly on the next one.
You should be in marketing, Flash. That was beautiful.
Yeah. Okay. No worries. I'll think about it. I'll give it some thought. So you said you had some workshops coming up. And I know that last time we spoke, you had some in August and in October, I think. Were they here in the States, or were they overseas?
I'm trying to recall our last conversation, but I did announce a whole bunch recently. Those have all sold out, but I have a couple more that I'm going to be announcing soon. So the ones that are out already are all the Death Valley workshops, the French Alps, and one of the Dolomite sessions, I think. And then I'm announcing another Dolomite session. Plus, something that's kind of unusual that's going to be coming up is I'm starting a traveling post-processing seminar, and that'll kick off in Munich in October, and then we'll head to the Canon Experience Center in Costa Mesa after that. So that'll be fun. Cool. And I also have Iceland, if I didn't mention that already, coming.
No, okay, Iceland as well. So, man, you are all over
the
place.
Yeah, I get around.
That's the beauty of living in America or Slovenia. Mm. You're so close to everything, whereas, you know,
it's kind of the benefit of having two offices. Each hub is near a lot of great stuff.
I think you're even closer to Antarctica than what we are, because even though we're physically closer, if we want to go to Antarctica from here, we generally have to zip across to South America and go down from there. Whereas you can just go straight down.
Yeah, and I will be doing that. I think next year I'm going to Antarctica.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Ah, well, just stop through Australia on your way back. It's only just up the road.
All right, swing on by.
yeah. Unfortunately, it's right around the other side of the world as well. So from South America, I think it's about a 13-hour flight to New Zealand, then another 7 hours to Perth. Mm. So, yeah, it's still a long way to go.
Aaron, can I just ask you, look, we're all pretty well aware now that of your fire situation. You lost your home in the Californian wildfires, I guess. Can I just ask you, how's the recovery going? You're obviously set up again in California, but is there any sort of semblance of, you know, life coming back to normal?
It's still a ways off. I've just bought a house in Slovenia that will be an upgrade over what I had. I always just had a tiny little office there, so this was the fastest way for me to get set up with a space that is going to be even better than what I lost, because at least there I had a little something to grow from. What I've got here in California, I consider temporary. It'll hold me over for a couple of years until I get that one set up, but at least it's somewhere to go and to work from. And I would say that I, you know, in another year, I should be maybe back to where I was before the fire. So it's quite a setback. It's a long, slow process, you know. When you don't even have basic household items or tools or anything to set up a house, it's kind of a daunting thing to have to do. So I started over there, because at least there I have some stuff. Not a lot, but enough to get going.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, yeah, that's just, I mean, you've been having really bad fires over there as well, like this year.
Yeah,
as well.
There's that too.
I've noticed it through California.
It doesn't make me feel like I'm in any hurry to set up another house in California, let me tell you.
Yeah, well, just when you do, just make sure it's a suburb that's already been burnt out, and then it won't be as pretty to live in, but at least it'll be fire
safe.
Yeah,
I mean, how does your mind honestly work? I don't even know where I'm going to go. That is another big part of the problem over here. It's a big decision right there. The town I did live in is wiped off the map. The water isn't even drinkable. So that's a project right there. Just deciding where.
Well, Well, hopefully you'll get that all sorted out and get back on board. But look, I was just looking at your website and I was thinking about your prints and how beautiful they are. I noticed that you sell them online and stuff, but do you sell them through any galleries in America or around the world?
No, I have had several requests, and because of my issues with not being able to sort of handle inventory, I've shied away from that, and that was a big part of getting that house was so that I would have places to put the prints and be able to handle that. I'm moving in that direction, though. Yeah. Canon's going to be sending me a large format printer soon, and I'm really very, very excited to get into printing in a big way and really change my whole approach to how I view that end of things. Instead of sort of shying away from it, I really want to embrace it and go whole hog on it soon.
Yeah, oh, that's good. Well, I think you should, because your work is stunning and it needs to be seen. I mean, it's one thing to have it on a website or on Instagram and stuff, but images like that. I was just looking through them again this morning, and it made me just sort of like, you know when you're looking at good work because you just wish that you had taken it. I think that's the best compliment you give someone. You go, oh damn, why didn't I take that one? Oh, why wasn't I there to see that?
Means
I think
a
that's
lot
what your work does.
Coming from you, Fletcher. Thank you, Christian. Thank you very much.
Oh no, you can call me Fletch. That's all right. We're all friends here. That's a kind thing that people say to me.
Where actually are you in California?
The Sierra foothills on the west side, way out in a very remote area.
So who's your football team?
Don't have one. Football never really was my sport. I don't even know if I would have to ask a neighbor what the local football team might be, because we're not near any towns. It's an hour to the nearest gas station where I'm at right now. It's very remote. Yes.
Oh, wow.
The reason I bring that up is we had a chat on the phone a couple of weeks ago, and I just sort of said, because I like NFL, who's your favourite football team? And I was just having a chat with Fletch before off the air, and I said, I like the Green Bay Packers. So for our US audience, you know exactly what I'm talking about, Aaron Rodgers, Green Bay Packers. And you made the remark that that there's a lot of landscape photographers that like the Green Bay Packers.
It seems that way. Every year when it's football season, my Facebook feed fills up with landscape photographers talking about the Packers. So I don't know why that is, but there's definitely a connection there.
Fletcher's just shaking his head. He's just got no idea.
I'm not a sporty kind of guy, and I don't follow football here or any sort of codes like that. I played soccer for 5 years, and I was at a conference, and I met this guy. And we're going to get him on our podcast, but he's a keen photographer. Anyway, met this guy, and we had a bit of a chat, and I said, hey, how you going, mate? Yeah, how you going? Yeah. I'm such and such. And anyway, someone pulled me aside and said, do you know who you just spoke to? He's the most famous soccer player Australia has ever had. And I went, oh, really? Great. Oh, that's good. And Craig Johnson. And I went back and said to him, I said, look, mate, I just found out who you are. I just want to tell you about my soccer story. And normally he has people come up to him and say, I used to be this awesome player for this team. And I remember I kicked this goal one time from the back line. It just flew through the air and curved and went sideways. And the goalie had no chance of stopping it. And it went in and saved it. I went up and said, mate, I played soccer for 5 years. I was left wing, which means I was in the forward line. And my whole job was to kick goals. I played for 5 years and I didn't score one goal in 5 years. Even at training, I didn't score a goal. And he thought that was the best story ever, because everyone else is always going up telling how good they are. So that's as sporty as I am. I have no idea. I didn't know. I thought NFL was something that we had here in Australia, but apparently it's an American thing. So,
yeah,
go figure.
Big fan over here.
Go figure. Yeah. Anyway, we're sort of getting a bit sidetracked, Carmen.
Yeah, sorry about that.
It's not a sport podcast. It's about photography. Hey, when you start making your prints, what are you gonna print on? What's your favorite? What's your favorite paper?
Well, I had just gotten started with doing my own in-house printing, and that first printer that they gave me had burned. So, but I was really having fun with it. They sent me this box full of all the different papers to play with, and I was really getting into that. I was fascinated by the ones that have kind of a metallic sheen on them for certain photographs, and then others that were a little bit more matte that brought out the qualities of other photographs. So to me, it wasn't that I liked one paper across the board. It was, I loved pairing them. So I'd find that, you know, for example, I had this one photograph of mud tiles in Death Valley that had an almost metallic look to them already. And so I put that on the metallic paper and it just, I felt like you could just reach into the image and, you know, almost pull out one of those tiles. It was incredibly, the match was great. And then there was another one where the textures of the image had more of a leathery surface. And so that matte paper really brought that out. So yeah, I don't think I had a favorite. I like mixing and matching.
Yeah. Look at that. And they definitely do different types of media do make some images look better than others. In our gallery, we print mainly on matte paper because, especially when we're going, having them framed under glass, because part of the reason that I like is that once it goes under glass, that you don't see that matte finish anymore. It looks shiny, but if you look at there's no reflection off the print surface. So obviously, you know, reflections off framed prints are always or can be an issue if you've got the wrong lighting for them. And when you look at those matte prints, if you look up and look for any reflections, you don't see it. You see some reflection off the glass, so it just reduces that reflection down by, well, not by half, but by another quarter at least. So that's why we use it. So, I love all of the different papers as well, but mainly we just print on the rag, Canson rag photographic.
Uh-huh. That's sort of a good all rounder.
Yeah, it's a beautiful paper. Yeah, and I think the last time we chatted, we didn't get too technical. I know that you're a big fan of Photoshop.
Absolutely.
And you learnt from a very early age. But do you use any other software for your editing at all? I mean, maybe Lightroom or whatever else, or Capture One.
I recently had someone reach out to me about trying out Capture One. I'll see if that comes to anything. But the only time I ever tried that was very brief, and I didn't get very far with it. So it's really just Lightroom and Photoshop for me. But there's so much you can do with those two that I don't feel like I'm missing out.
Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, Photoshop's my little the software that I use all the time, pretty much for everything. But I've just recently got a hold of, well, actually not recently, it's been the last 2 or 3 years, there was a program called 3D LUT Creator. Have you heard
it
of that one?
It sounds familiar. I've not used it.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's, if you want to mess with color, do anything with color, actually it does everything. It does. It's got curves. It's, you can use all the different color modes, but still be an RGB. It's all sorts of weird stuff. And, but have a look at it if you get a chance. 3D LUT Creator. It's made by a Russian guy, and apparently there's no collusion if you use it. There's no chance of getting in trouble with the authorities over there if you use a Russian program.
Okay.
But I wouldn't go putting any too many details about banking details. And all that stuff.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah, very, very important. But yeah, 3D LUT Creator, it's amazing. I've done a couple of little tutorials on it and got a few more coming up. But it's, really awesome. So yeah, just for the fact that you can control color in such an amazing way, well worth having a look at.
Aaron, what do you do for inspiration? What inspires you on a daily basis to do what you do?
I'm pretty well self-motivated most of the time, but whenever I feel as though I'm a little burned out, I turn to sources of input. I like to go to museums. I like to
read.
What's that?
Marijuana.
I think that would just slow me down. No, I find all sorts of inspiration in reading about art. It's interesting how maybe that just sort of pushes different buttons in my brain than normally, you know, because it's not as visual, or because the brain has to imagine things more that way. And I find that if I sit down with a book, pretty soon I'm all fired up and I just want to get right back to doing whatever it is that I do, which isn't always just processing photos or going out and creating them. I also enjoy writing, and not only writing articles, but writing my talks, because I do a lot of speaking. And so the books just seem to feed all of that. So that's one thing that I do. And I also enjoy, as I said, going out to look at art of all sorts, not just other photography, but anything that's just that it can make me think, wow, someone actually did that. That's crazy. Or you know,
yeah, yeah.
You know, for recently I saw a video on now I'm gonna forget his name, but the guy who specializes in earthworks, it'll come to me. But you know, it's just something that's it just reminds me of a different practices in any medium where you just push something beyond what is normal and try to stretch outside the box. And anything that reminds me that that's fun to do is inspirational to me.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that you read books to get inspiration, because we had a guest on way back in the early days, Julianne Cost. Do you know Julianne?
The name sounds familiar.
She's a debut evangelist.
Name sounds familiar, but I don't think I think
she. Yeah, well, she said the same thing. She said she reads books, and that gives her inspiration for photographs and photographic ideas, and not necessarily photographic books, but just books about other things. And then all of a sudden that just spurs something in her, and she becomes, you know, gets some creative ideas. And I think that's really amazing. I think, you know, one of the hardest things is to create new and interesting work. What do you think makes a compelling landscape photograph?
I recently just put together a talk to try to answer that question when I was speaking for Canon at the Photo Plus Expo last month. And I really thought it through, and I had this big list of things that I had come up with a friend, actually, about, 5 years ago. We had this big list, and as is usually the case when I have these big lists, I start to think about it and I realize I've really got not 10 things, but 2 or 3. They all start to settle down into, you know, these groupings. And what I hit upon and what I came out with for that talk is, I feel as though it's really comes down to kind of 3 things. It's what you find. So when you feel as though you've found something that you haven't seen before, you know, and that could be anything. It could even be at a familiar location, but you found another way of looking at it, or timing it, or what, or framing it, or whatever it is. So what you find might be in a whole new location, whatever it is. What you create, you know, in that case, it can be that you've decided to create something that can't even really be seen, such as a focus stack or something like that. So you created a new way of sort of looking at something that's maybe familiar again, same kind of thing. And then most importantly, I think, is what you suggest. And by that, I'm really talking about storytelling, essentially. But when an image actually suggests something to you, whether it is an idea, very strongly suggests an idea, or it suggests a kind of a dialogue going on between features within the landscape, or it suggests something that it's not because of, you know, the tendencies of abstraction or something like that, where it looks like something that it's not. Any of these things, though, any of these things tend to make for a compelling landscape. And when you put all 3 of those together, chances are you've got a real winner.
Do you ever get to the point where you've just got no inspiration? Like, I mean, probably, you know, after seeing your house burn down, did you just sort of think, you know, I'm just over it, I've just got nothing?
I think that for me, it's not so much that I feel uninspired, but I will feel exhausted. So I don't know why it is that, but I don't seem to hit that kind of like creative roadblock. What I hit is this point where I realize that I need to take a break and I need to go do some input, you know, and it can't be output all the time. So yeah, I do get to the point where I feel as though I cannot produce right now. And it's not because I feel as though I've done everything and I'm out of ideas. It's just because I'm exhausted. And I know that I just need to get those flames fanned again and get myself rested up and ready to be creative again. Because those, whenever you're out with a camera and you're well rested and you're feeling energetic, at least in my experience, you can't help but be creative. You know, you'll be more curious, you'll walk further, you'll try harder, and you know, in my experience, that always leads to something. I start in this playful, happy mood, and I work through it until I lock onto an idea, and then it becomes kind of an obsession, and eventually that obsession becomes a shot. That's just how it works. But if you're exhausted, you'll never get past square one.
Yeah. Do you find that your workshops wear you out? Do you think they hinder your creativity at times, or do you gain inspiration from workshops as well?
The workshops, because I do so many, sometimes it's just a point of physical exhaustion for me. The way that I run a workshop is typically it's about their photos, not mine, the participants' photos. So I'm usually running laps around a large area, making sure that I'm working with everybody. And if they need any kind of input, if they want, you know, just to discuss what it is that they're seeing, or if they need help finding a composition or whatever it is, I want to make sure that I'm around for them. So I literally run myself ragged.
So you're actually very hands-on in your workshops. Like you're actually, you know, you help people with their compositions.
I'm right there to, usually it's compositions that they need a lot of help with, but other times they come up with questions that are of a more kind of philosophical nature while they're out there, and you know, what am I doing here, what is my story, and we talk it through, you know, what attracted you to this, why are you standing over here, what attracted you, let's talk about that, right. You know.
So do you think that's why it's important to attend a workshop?
Absolutely. I think that if all you ever do is just sort of go out on your own, you're going to stagnate at some point. You need some kind of infusion of other ways of seeing things. And even if it's just so much as standing alongside someone and then seeing their photo later and thinking, where was that? Right next to me? Really? It's wonderful to see what other people come up with.
Yeah.
So often I'll have people all know kind of a small area, And later they'll all be comparing photos, and that question invariably comes up. Where were you when you took that? Standing 2 feet away from you. You know? They all have very different photographs. So, I want to be there for them so that they can ask me questions at any point. Mm-hmm. And I think that really does help. And that's why I get a lot of full-time landscape photographers taking my workshops, because they too realize that at some point, you know, you just need to mix things up, get some fresh ideas going.
It's interesting you said that, you know, there's established landscape photographers still doing your workshops. And I think, you know, a lot of us sort of think, oh, you know, I'm above learning, I've learned everything. But I just want to ask you this question. If you could do a workshop with any landscape photographer in the world, living or dead, who would it be?
Oh, wow. That's a really, really good question. I would, you know, that's going to require, I'm going to probably be up all night thinking about that. Because I have never taken a workshop.
Sorry.
For all that I just said, I find my sources
Christian
of inspiration. You know, in like I said, in books and museums and all over the place. But one thing I haven't ever done is actually schedule some time, because scheduling time for me is very difficult. my schedule's so full. Saying I'm going to take off that week to go do that.
Would it be like an Ansel Adams or somebody like that?
Perhaps. I think it would be really interesting to work alongside Ansel Adams. I've done a lot of reading about him and about the F-64 group, and I think any of them from that era would be, you know, particularly interesting. I'm gonna have to think about that. That's a really good question. Living or dead?
Yeah, well, I've got a name for you. It's an Australian man, a guy named Les Walkling. We've just been interviewing him. Les is a friend of mine. I've known him for quite a while, and he would be the smartest, most articulate person in photography in Australia, yeah, without a doubt, and art. And he knows. I mean, I know you were into art history and did all that, and you love that. Les is exactly the same. He knows all about art history, color management, Photoshop. Mm. Very technical, but also he lives in the contemporary art world, not the classic,
fantastic,
commercial art world. So Les Walkling, he
sounds
would
like
be
my kind of guy.
Someone that
you should
look up. Yeah, he actually, when he was a young lad, he went to America and studied under a guy named Frederick Sommer, and went over to Princeton University and did a whole lot of stuff there, research and all these things, and met up with a whole bunch of really contemporary art photographers in America, and then furthered his studies here in Australia, and then became a professor at RMIT and was teaching art and colour for 20 years. So, yeah, amazing guy. So look him up, Les Walkling, walk with a L-I-N-G. He's the way he thinks and the deepness of the conversation that you can get into with him is just incredible.
Fantastic.
The thing I love about Les is you can actually do a workshop with the guy. And to my mind, that's like, you know, he's like our, you know, Australia's Ansel Adams. And it blows me away that you could actually go on a workshop with Les.
He's the only guy I would pay to go see personally in Australia. I do stuff with him. And we've got a workshop coming up in the Daintree next year where I go along as a co-presenter, but I just sit there in awe of this guy. And it's one of those situations where, you know, you've got this presenter that you're with who is so unbelievable that you just feel so not unbelievable when you come up next. You know, like you're either the pre-show or the follow-up that everyone falls asleep in the middle of. So it's incredible, but yeah, look him up.
I
Les
will,
Walkling.
Absolutely. Thanks for the tip.
He's a genius.
It is always great having a chat with you, Aaron, and we're going to be back next week with Malaysia's Wesley Snipes. Well, no, his name is actually Wesley Wong, so we're crossing live to Malaysia next week. We hope to see you then. Bye.